I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, the popular mythology of 20th century American history says that United States counterculture, that zeitgeist often dubbed the Age of Aquarius, in which rebellious youths experimented with psychedelic drugs and ideas of sexual liberation, began and ended in the 1960s. Our guest on this edition of Parallax Views, scholar of all things esoteric, Eric Davis, argues otherwise. In his new book, High Weirdness, Drugs, Esoterica, and Visionary Experience in the 70s, Davis excavates a whole countercultural moment in the 1970s through the figures of sci-fi author Philip K. Dick, philosopher Robert Anton Wilson, and psychedelic explorer Terence McKenna. Vis-a-vis the concept of going through the Chapel Perilous, defined more or less as an experience which causes one to question his or her reality, Davis ties together these three iconic figures. In this conversation, Eric and I discuss the book, the cultural moment of the 1970s, and how, in the 21st century, we may, as a society, be experiencing a collective high weirdness and chapel perilous experience. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to my conversation with Eric Davis, author of High Weirdness, Drugs, Esoterica, and Visionary Experience in the 70s. Welcome to Parallax Views, Eric Davis, author of High Weirdness, a really interesting book that I highly recommend to my listeners. How are you doing today, Eric?
I'm doing great. Good to be here.
So, Eric, I guess we should start with maybe a little background on who you are, what you do, what you write about, because you sort of toe that line between highbrow academic sort of scholarly writing and, you know, I guess middle or I don't want to say lowbrow, because I don't even like that distinction, really, but sort of pop cultural stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually okay with the high-low approach to it. Actually, I write for this blog called High Lowbrow sometimes, and they capture – there's something about my generation, I think, that really derived a lot out of that particular conjunction, and it's definitely something
– I was going to ask, are you familiar with Makeda Brotman? She wrote a whole book about low culture, high theory, so – I was very influenced by that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would consider her to be part of my generation in that sense, and and so I've always been into that. You know, when I was studying, you know, deconstruction and literary theory, I was at the same time, you know, starting to write about rock music and pop music and more rock, and but I did it in a super like. Alternative journalism kind of way. So for me, these things have always been together. You know, I've always been a link between my intellectual interests and my obsession with popular culture or with low culture or fringe culture or marginal culture. And that's, you know, it's on display in most of my work, nearly all of my work probably, and definitely with high weirdness. I mean, that's partly the whole role of the weird. Is, you know, a weird culture is almost by definition, it's not only marginal, but it's, there's something a little tawdry to it, a little adolescent, a little bit over the top, a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, a hint of rot to it or something. And so combining that with like intellectual aspiration is to me just a real gas.
Well, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar with this idea of high weirdness, how would you describe it? I believe it's first used by Reverend Ivan Stang of the Church of the Subgenius.
Yeah, and he doesn't really define it. He just kind of demonstrates it. He kind of expresses it. And what he's doing in his book is just, you know, he's basically saying, look, there's a lot of weird culture out there. There's a lot of weird people, a lot of weird ideas. And if you line yourself up right, you get exposed to a lot of it, and it's just at the very least entertaining, also informative, also fascinating, also obsessive. And so he was interested in how you could tune into all these, you know, it was the pre-internet days, how you could use the mails to subscribe or send letters to all of these extremely bizarre groups, and they would send you their material, and just the material itself was charged with the sense of high weirdness. So I kind of poached the term and took it a little bit in a different direction using it to refer not just to cultural material stuff that's weird, like peculiar religions, conspiracy theories, psychedelic stories, you know, weird fiction, you know, over the top fantasy, that kind of stuff, cults. But also as a kind of experience, like what happens to you when like your actual lived experience begins to resemble like a character in a weird fiction novel or the person in a conspiracy theory who suddenly wakes up to the reality of all these hidden forces, when that becomes a mode of experiencing the world. And that's something that, you know, it happens to a lot of people. It happens in psychosis. It happens in mystical experience sometimes. It happens definitely in psychedelic experience some of the time. It happens in our dreams. It happens even if we start to put together the pieces of random information. We start to draw links between them and start to research our way into down some rabbit hole. So it's a relatively common kind of experience. And I really wanted to just sort of highlight it and talk about the dynamics and indeed the relationship between weird culture and weird experience and how they create a kind of feedback loop, and that's part of the weirdness is that it's like the texts you're reading come alive. The weird speculative concepts you have are now manifesting themselves in your day-to-day reality or in your extraordinary reality. So in a way, it's a way of talking about what we used to call religious experience or mystical experience or what we could call that, but without the idea of religion, without the idea of some particular mystical reality. Instead, it's just like when reality gets weird and you're there and you can't, how are you going to get out of it? What are you going to do with it? Do you believe it? Do you try to escape it? And so for me, psychedelics really pose that question. That's one of the most interesting things about them, is they pose that question. What do you do with this stuff? And especially after the fact. So I was really interested in characters who were pushing the limits of these experiences and these texts, these ways of writing or culturally expressing these experiences. And so that was really what I wanted to do with that's one element of what I was trying to do with High Weirdness, by concentrating on these three, you know, highly weird people who had highly weird experiences: Terrence McKenna, Philip K. Dick, and Robert Anton Wilson. So that they were, because they wrote weird books and they had weird experiences, I could really track these feedback loops and do it in, like you say, like an intellectual way to some extent, but also to really just revel in the weirdness and the detail and the cultural resonance of their experiences.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned the three pivotal figures in this book are Terrence McKenna, Philip K. Dick, and Robert Anton Wilson. And this sort of brings me back to the high-low distinction, just real quick, because I guess sometimes I get annoyed with the high-low distinction just because I feel like sometimes there's a lot of taste-mongering that goes into it. And particularly when I look at someone like Robert Anton Wilson, I actually think Robert Anton Wilson and also someone like Timothy Leary were saying a lot of the same things as the French postmodernist thinkers that are considered, you know, a high theory within a lot of academia. And I think they even share some of the same interests. You know, Baudrillard wrote about the Gulf War never happened, which sort of toyed with conspiracy theory. And of course, that's something that Robert Anton Wilson, that was basically his career, was toying with conspiracy theories while himself being, you know, a rather skeptical person about those things.
Yeah, no, I think you're drawing a very accurate connection. It's interesting. Later on in his career, Wilson in particular, you know, talks about postmodern thinkers. He talks about Foucault and Derrida or whatever, and he's not super familiar with them, but he recognizes that there's something similar there. My approach to that, I mean, in a way, you could say that they're the same. Recognition, the same insight about the emergence of a new kind of cultural logic or a new kind of problem with the idea of truth or reality that's manifesting at different levels. And so it happens inside of philosophical circles, inside of literary theory or academic circles, and that's the highbrow, but it also happens inside of you know, underground culture and marginal culture, and it's also happening inside art. So one of the ways I look at it is to think of postmodernism not so much as an argument or a philosophy or even a particular kind of culture. It is all of those things, or was. But all of those are symptoms of something bigger, which is an actual mutation in technological, capitalist, you know, consensus reality. And that I think is really true. So I think that you know, there's a reason that my book is set in the 1970s, and that Robert Anton Wilson and these other guys are very 70s figures.
It's very interesting too. I didn't mean to interrupt. I wanted to say it was very interesting to me that you picked the 70s, because we always hear about the 60s counterculture. I always want to hear more about the 70s though.
Yeah. And one reason is, it gets back to this other question about postmodernism, is that the 70s is where postmodernism comes from. That's when people first start talking about it. That's when these theorists like Foucault and Derrida really start making a difference, and they start getting read in America, and those ideas start to spread. And that's all happening, I believe, because of fundamental changes in the way society is run, the emergence of computer networks, the kind of shift to a sort of consumer credit economy. There's lots of things that we could talk about that are staging this mutation, a mutation that we're still in. It's just we're in a different phase of it, much more aggressively unpleasant one, although the 70s weren't exactly a walk in the park. So that was one reason I was interested in the 70s. Another reason is the one you're talking about, where if we're interested in the counterculture, if we're influenced by the counterculture, if we consider ourselves part of that currency or that transmission, as I do in many ways, we tend to always think about the 60s, but we don't really think about the 70s, when actually that's when a lot of the 60s, so to speak, really became an option for a lot of people. That's when people really started living within these new modes of sex and drugs and rock and roll and mysticism and human potential movement and hedonism and exploration and experimenting with the new and different kinds of utopian ideas that resisted all of the kind of ideology of a mainstream America. That's when all that stuff kind of spread and also became more a part of mainstream culture. You know, it's like rock bands in the late 60s are still largely kind of marginal events from the perspective of mainstream corporate America. But, you know, by the end of the 1970s, they are mainstream corporate America. You know, that is, you know, Fleetwood Mac or whatever. You know, it's so that all that transformation is happening in the 70s, which makes it much more interesting to me. And I think much more important. I think we are much more the children of the 70s than of the 60s in a lot of ways.
Well, I was going to comment, it's interesting when you look at I'm a big cinema buff, right? And I love like the really weird exploitation movies that came out in the 70s. And there's sort of a freeness to a lot of 70s cinema. A lot of people think, you know, the sexual experimentation and all that was just over by the end of the 60s because, you know, the hippies looked very bad after the Manson murders. Although I don't consider Manson a hippie, but that's another story. But the 70s, there was a lot of room for talking about drugs, sexual exploration, rock and roll. You can see it in the movies, the music, all kinds of different areas.
Oh yeah, that's. I mean, and this is where it kind of loops around a part of my interest in it. I was born in the Summer of Love, so I was shaped. My first sort of cultural environment was the early 70s, when I'm starting to realize there's a world outside of my, you know, my little childhood domain. My first sense of like larger world was the 1970s. And I think that people of my generation were really had an unusual set of cultural imprints, because this culture we were taking in was made by heads, or a lot of it was. So it was made by people who had gone through the counterculture and were, you know, writing comic books or making movies or whatever. And so we were really like influenced by this sort of cultural mutation that came out of these kinds of experiences. And so that's always been one of the interests in the 1970s for me personally, is just feeling like I'm kind of excavating the context that really first shaped my impression of the world. Because you're totally right that even if, like, I don't know, if like there, you know, the wind went out of the sails of the kind of revolutionary counterculture, what was left was just all of these new ways of being or different ways of being that people explored and continue to explore, and it spread, and it was in the, you know, it's all through the popular media in the 1970s. The occult revival is all, you know, it's In Search Of is on TV. You know, it's just, there's just tons of this material now that, looking back, if you're like a cultural archivist or archaeologist, you just see tons of this stuff on in the mainstream and, you know, also in the underground.
Well, you know, I want to get back to the topic of the counterculture, because I've become a little bit more critical of the 60s and 70s counterculture over time. But first, before we do that, I wanted to ask you about, we can't really get into the three characters of this story, the three musketeers of high weirdness, in depth. But I think we can cover the sort of thing that binds them together. And I would say that is the idea of the Chapel Perilous. Maybe you can describe what that is and how it relates to McKenna, Wilson, and Dick.
Sure. Chapel Perilous is a phrase that Wilson developed. It comes from the kind of Grail myth. And it for Wilson, it describes a time and a place in someone's life when, because things have gotten so highly weird, meaning they're not just reading highly weird material, but experiencing highly weird things, you kind of pass a point of no return where things are so weird that as he puts it, you really only have two choices. There's really only two ways to exit Chapel Perilous once you're in it. One is you come out a raging paranoid, i.e. you believe it all. You lose the plot, as the British say. You swallow the crazy story. You become obsessed. You become paranoid. You become a glassy-eyed cultist, whatever it is. Or you come out an agnostic. And that meant recovering a sort of maybe logic, in Wilson's terms, an ability to be in the midst of these very strange scenarios and possibilities, and while not entirely denying them, not letting them sort of take over your whole worldview. And so that's a kind of process, in a way, that is in some ways inherent in high weirdness and in experiences that go that way. And in some ways, we can look at all three of these guys as going through their own Chapel Perilous and making their own sort of arrangements, their own negotiations with how to exit it. And it's not as clear as one or the other. Usually it's a mix of both. And I think that's true of Wilson too, though he largely, you know, regained his skeptical, critical temperament after his own experience of believing that he was being communicated with by extraterrestrials associated with the star system Sirius. That, nonetheless, he also, you know, the door was open for lots of weird possibilities. And in some ways, he was quite a believer in parapsychology in a way that, you know, makes him less look like less of a skeptic. And I think that Phil Dick and Terence McKenna, in their own ways, also had kind of, they sort of came to terms with a sort of contradictory mix of skepticism and belief, on the far side of their experiences. But in a way that makes them interesting figures. And I think in some ways we're all like that. I think like a pure skeptic is a weird life to live, that we do all have curious investments with some possibilities that can't be proven. But in the case of these guys, you know, it's a more extreme, situation. So I think they do all share. And that's what makes the story different than a story about religious experience, where it's all just about belief or lack of belief, is that high weirdness doesn't stop when you're a skeptic. That's a really key element that we get from. In fact, in some ways, it might even intensify it. And in a similar way, I think that for all the talk of psychedelic spirituality, of mysticism, of oneness with God, of all of that kind of religious language, that psychedelics also support and have supported a very rich culture that acknowledges both a kind of grounded, secular, materialist, skeptical attitude towards reality, while still acknowledging that there are these mysteries and wonders and enigmas and resonances and strange intuitions that are also in some sense part of reality. So that I think Chapel Perilous is a real key element to the whole story I'm telling.
Well, it's very interesting too. Wilson for me is my favorite sort of character from this book, because he's really in a lot of ways a singular thinker, I think, within 20th century American thought. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, Wilson was a libertarian, but he would bash Ayn Rand. He would bash Murray Rothbard. I forget what the one essay he wrote was, but he wrote a whole essay, Always Put a Condom on Your Willy or something.
No. Okay. I'll quote that, because that's one of my favorite Wilson books, and it's one nobody ever talks about. I think it's one of the best. Natural Law, or Don't Put a Rubber on Your Willy.
Right. Well, he criticizes the libertarian sort of way of thinking there. And then, you know, he's, as you said, he's into parapsychology, but he's skeptical of a lot of conspiracy theories and supernatural explanations. But at the same time, he'll write a book like The New Inquisition, which I almost feel like there's a little bit of commonality with Bruno Latour in ways there.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I think there is some, you know, his approach to science was sociologically grounded, and he was interested in science. He was always, he had studied engineering. You know, he read a lot of systems theory. He knew, you know, a decent amount about quantum physics. And while he liked the weird side of quantum physics, he wasn't like just a new age hippie about it. He hung out with some of those kind of fringe physicists in the 70s and 80s. And so, you know, he knew and respected science, but he also recognized that science was a cultural institution, that it uses language, which has all sorts of problems associated. So in a way, he was in a position to understand the kind of constructed aspect of science without throwing out, you know, the baby out with the bathwater and saying, oh, it's all just relative. So, I mean, he really is a fascinating postmodern thinker who had a very interesting politics. I mean, he is a singular thinker. I mean, he's definitely the most intellectually substantial of the three figures. I mean, Phil Dick had a very interesting way of thinking about life and religion and reality, but it's best manifest in his books. I mean, he's ultimately, the reason we're talking about him is because he's a great novelist, even though his religious experiences and his religious theories are very interesting, or at least in part. You know, Wilson is really the most, I think probably the most important character in my book that people don't talk about. Like, unless you're influenced by Wilson, unless you, you know, went through your adolescent Robert Anton Wilson phase, nobody talks about him. There's no academic literature about him. In histories of the, you know, the counterculture, people don't really talk about him. So unless you're into like chaos magic or you know, fringe libertarianism, or you were, you know, around Bonza 2000 in the 1990s or whatever, he's sort of not part of the larger memory of the time. And so one of the things I wanted to do with the book was to, you know, provide a kind of intellectual biography of him, give a sense of his significance and of his singularity. And I think you're totally right that he was a singular thinker, and the whole, you know, since you brought up libertarianism, and I know that was one of the things you wanted to talk about, because it's very interesting story. It's very complicated. It's like a lot of things, you know, it's nice to put things in a box and go, ooh, libertarians, they're awful. Oh, my God. But, you know, you have to recognize that, A, libertarian means different things. It meant different things in the 60s and 70s.
Before that, it was originally a very left wing sort of thing, like libertarian socialism, and then it sort of becomes a more right wing thing in the popular consciousness with time.
Well, it's complicated because it's a term, right? So if I said anarchist, that it would have a different set of registers, but it's not entirely different, you know. And then you get into this problem of the difference between left wing anarchism. So if we just say anarchism, which isn't associated with the right wing, and it has very similar characters, we could say, well, there's like left wing anarchism, which is more social oriented. It has to do with collectives and worker, autonomous worker collectives, and imagining how different collectives would operate without a state. And then you have like what you could call right wing anarchism, which is much more about the individual. So, you know, right now there's like a big thing in the meme world of Max Stirner, which is hilarious. But Max Stirner is a really important figure for Robert Anton Wilson. And Stirner, you know, he's a late 19th century thinker. He's kind of more of a radical individualist than Nietzsche. And it's hilarious that he's become this kind of meme figure. And I really like it because he's like the guy you turn to who's just going to reject all of your general abstract language about society and collectives and all of the sort of what he called spooks that we create intellectually to justify our behavior. And he's just interested in the radical singular experience of being an individual and recognizing that in some sense, that's the only game in town. And then there's no ground for it. And, you know, it's kind of proto existential. And I'm not defending these ideas, although I think Stirner is a very important person to recognize with. But the idea of spooks is really key to understanding Robert Anton Wilson, because while, Wilson was interested in lots of different ideas and lots of different ways of thinking, he was also very distrustful of the way that language could sort of obscure, your experience of being a person in reality with making decisions and, you know, living your life, and how a lot of collective movements were full of these abstractions, you know, big ideas about the collective, the workers' collective, the march of history, dialectical materialism, like all these big abstractions that were used to understand society, which is itself, from a Stirner perspective, a spook. And while recognizing that these things are all part of the picture, what does it mean to really distrust the spooks? And it means that there's a kind of emphasis more on radical sovereignty or individual responsibility. And as you point out, that doesn't necessarily mean right wing. And one of the interesting stories that I talk about to some degree in the book, and I was happy to excavate some, although there's a lot more to be said, and again, it's something people don't really think about, is that there's a very important libertarian side of, or if you want to say anarchist side, but an individualist anarchist side of the counterculture. And, you know, there's a, not just in the sense that like, hey man, everybody's got their own thing, man, you know, don't judge, you know, just let everybody explore it. That's one level, a kind of hedonic, anything goes social philosophy. But there's something more radical going on that has to do with sort of, you know, intense autonomy and intense responsibility. And for some of these libertarian figures, let's say, who had gone through Ayn Rand, so some of like Wilson was interested in Ayn Rand at some point, although he never was a card-carrying member. Other folks that he was hanging around with in the Discordian movement had been Randies. And they go through that, and then they come out the other end, and they go, that's just insane. Like, no way. And what you see in the 60s is that some libertarians start to go and start to enter into the anti-war movement, and they start taking drugs, and they start having, you know, polyamorous sex, and they start, you know, exploring the diving into the counterculture, but not because they believed it was going to bring about some kind of collectivist transformation. But rather in the sense of a kind of radical, like, you know, a radical autonomy, radical freedom, radical whatever that meant. And, you know, that has a lot to do with some of the forms of political protest in the 60s. You know, the Yippies were kind of like a mix of, you know, anarcho-libertarians and leftists, and they had this kind of weird, like, rapprochement between them, where they were still invested in the large ideas of the new left, but their actual practice was much more a kind of prankster libertarian thing. And the prankster and the libertarian go real close, or the anarchists go really, really hand in hand. So that whole trickster side of the 60s and 60s politics, you know, it comes off a lot of this stuff. So it was a great story. I'll finish up. It's a great story to kind of dig out, because today libertarians, for totally good reason, you know, are anathema to many of us. The way it manifests now in terms of radical market libertarianism. Wilson never liked that shit. He didn't like the Randies, and he didn't like the Hayek, you know, market rules all guys. He thought that basically for a lot of those kind of market libertarians, they just hated poor people. And he was a poor person. He came from a working class background. He often had no money in his life. He had great sympathy for poor people, and he wasn't interested in some kind of justification for some like capitalist Ubermensch. That was not at all what he was interested in. He was interested in something more existential, more hedonic, more erotic. And, you know, it has its problems. He's definitely a patriarch, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's not a perfect picture by any means, even politically. But it's just really important, because I've had a lot of conversations about him, is if you use the word libertarian, people think you mean a Silicon Valley narcissistic asshole with like no care for any people who are struggling, and they just want to be able to do whatever they want to do and manifest their Ubermensch fantasies. And that is a true archetype today, and to some degree always was, but it's the whole history of libertarianism and anarchism because in some ways libertarianism is like a word for American anarchism. So it's a much richer, more complicated story that was really fun and that Wilson lets you play with and wrestle with and disagree with, but in a way that's different than some of the pieties and the kind of abstractions or spooks that drive so much political discourse today.
Well, it's interesting too, because until I read your book, I did not realize that Terence McKenna was actually a Ayn Rand fan. I kind of find that devastating, because I'm not a big fan of Rand, but I still like my McKenna.
Yeah, it was a youthful phase. I mean, he wasn't always a Randy. I think he like a lot of people. I mean, there's a sort of a certain point in one's life where I think it's okay to encounter and become obsessed with certain kinds of characters.
I think every white guy as a teenager goes through a libertarian phase, including myself.
I did as well. I wrote my I had a government class in high school. And I wrote my semester paper on like why Larry Flint was running for president, and it was all about like libertarian principles and all this stuff, and you know, so I think it's not a bad thing for that level as long as you come out the other side. It's like a lot of things are like that. A lot of things are like it's great to be like a complete Nietzsche head for a while and just get totally into Nietzsche, but don't stay there. keep moving. You know, a lot of things are like that, and I think, you know, Robert Anton Wilson, I think, is like that, and he's also someone who did that. He went through all of these kinds of phases, but you actually see it in McKenna. There's, you know, that was one thing I got to one of the intellectual treats of writing this book was I got access to Terrence's first book, which was never published. He wrote it in the end of the 1960s, so just after he left Berkeley. And he was, you know, traveling around and growing weed and dealing exotic statues and, you know, living the freak on the road life. And it's a youthful text. It's called Crypto Rap. It's kind of a rant. But you see a lot of elements of ideas that he would develop or continue to develop down the road. And I got to sit down and I read a copy, took some notes on it and included it in the book. And there it was really interesting because he has a very explicit passage where he's like, look, it's not about back to nature. It's about going forward. And that's one thing that all these guys share is it's not just libertarianism. It's libertarianism and technology, meaning the idea that technology is providing the mechanism for a new kind of freedom. And Timothy Leary was very much of this mind, especially in the 1970s. He turns in the 1970s towards a kind of embrace of futurism and space migration and intelligence expansion and new technologies, you know, a kind of rap that he had through the end of his life. And while he's always a little bit of a dubious character, there's real reasons that he's doing that. So there's this interesting mix, a kind of utopianism of possibility, that's partly manifest in an idea about technology and technological development. And all three of my subjects were all very obsessed and interested with technological development, with futurism. And so there's a certain connection there that you see today. That's why Silicon Valley, there's a lot of libertarians. There's something about technology and the way that it can disrupt and allow for new kinds of power and new kinds of freedom that lends itself to both interesting utopian thinking and also really crude forms of, selfish individualism. I think McKenna was very clear that he positioned himself as a radical, as an anti-authoritarian, someone who was very critical of society, but he was not a member of the new left. He was not just a kind of reflexive collectivist, you know, who admired, anti-colonialist movements and blah, blah, blah. He was more of a kind of radical freak who was interested in the transformation of reality, who didn't like the system, but he didn't see the answer in some kind of collective political movement so much as a kind of, there is a politics there, but it's more like a politics of ontological transformation.
Although I would add, I do think there is a very pro-social element to McKenna's work, especially when he talks about raves and the way he sort of views raves and the sort of letting go. But you're letting go of your inhibitions together with others. So I think it's not a completely – it's not just about the individual. And I guess that's what concerns me when looking at the counterculture and also today's Silicon Valley, because I think there are a lot of pitfalls that arise from, you know, psychedelics, mind expansion, occultism. Those are all things that I think are very interesting. But I kind of get wary of it at times because I feel like it's focused on individual emancipation. And I think there's also other forms of emancipation that can get thrown to the side. I think we can have social emancipations that happen as well. Maybe that's my sort of stereotypical lefty coming out, though. I don't know.
No, that's fine. Those are really valid critiques. I think in defense of this other position a little bit more is that I think not so much in terms of Dick, who's sort of a different figure politically and has some other even more explicitly conservative elements, at least in his later Christian phase.
He wasn't a fan of LSD, as far as I know. He was more of an amphetamine guy.
Yeah, not particularly. I mean, he took acid a handful of times and, you know, was influenced by it for sure and by the drug culture, but he wasn't personally a head in that way. I mean, he was a big head in other ways. But just to make the point is I think that the pro-social element comes out through this kind of appreciation for the Dionysian. So that aspect of the counterculture, the exaltation in collective psychic meltdown, in eros collectivized, in pleasure as a sort of element of social connection, that all of those things are also part of a radically of an anarchist kind of way of thinking about what's going to link people together, rather than the mechanism of a party, the mechanism of a social collective that is instrumentalized, that is, you know, constructed by a state-like form, and all those sort of the ways in which the traditional left have a great role for systems and structures and administrations and bureaucracies to play a role, that they have to exist to manage the transformation or the movement away from capital. And that the anarchist, more foolishly perhaps, believes that we can get by with mutual aid in a kind of eros sense, because we're all sort of in love with each other, or we're all able to participate in this deeper collectivity, but we don't need it to be managed by a party. And there's a lot of other dimensions to it. I think you're completely right that, in a way, this is sort of the paradox. If you look at like Burning Man, there's all sorts of like digital libertarian, rich techno singularity people out there. And yet the event itself is profoundly collective, and collective even in a kind of utopian way, in the sense of like, here's a different way to run a city. Here's a different way for people to be able to rely on each other to help, you know, fix things, to like have an open kind of an open tools approach to fixing problems and being accountable and things like that, at least on the kind of more utopian take on it. So it's a strange mix. I mean, I think that, there are people who are libertarians who do have a great sense of what a great social expression of freedom would look like, but they're probably pretty naive a lot of the time. And it's also very easy to kind of let go of the kind of a moral call, the ethical call of the other in that sort of libertarian mind frame. So people can become tremendously selfish, narcissist, individualist kind of people. I think those are legitimate criticisms to raise.
Well, I think with people like Robert Anton Wilson, I truly believe when he said, "No, I'm not a libertarian because I don't hate the poor." I truly believe he meant that. But there's some libertarians I think that put a nice gloss on some very dark things. We mentioned Rothbard, who was sort of, Robert Anton Wilson was not a fan. But Rothbard did a particularly good job of putting sort of a nice, happy face on some very dark things. I mean, this was a guy that wanted to, just abolish any forms of, government at all. And I mean, not in, I think, the left sort of anarchist way, but in this sort of a almost like feudal state kind of way. And I think there's different libertarians that have different approaches to this, but sometimes I think people can sneak really dark ideas in with a nice sort of sheen to it.
But don't you find that's true of politics in any direction you go?
Yes, that's very true. I know people on the left who have some very
odd views. Well, it's also just, you know, behind any militant is a totalitarian lurking. I mean, there's no way around it. And we may need militants in order to make radical change. We may need militancy in order to, you know, drive the sort of systematic shifts or to call people to arms or be able to collect people. And the problem, you know, but then you just look at history and you go, militancy is a, you know, is a mixed bag. And it often becomes very, you know, intoxicating. So that the anarchist critique of the classical anarchist critique of the left partly has to do with psychology and the psychology of militancy and the sort of and the abstractions, the use of abstractions, what Stirner or Wilson would call spooks, and how people deploy spooks as a way to kind of knock you off your own sort of what remains of common sense inside your perspective. So I think we're, you know, it's a weird place because there's really a lot of danger in pretty much all the options we have. I mean, I definitely prefer the progressive ones. With all that said, you know, give me certain forms of militancy, I'll take it. But I think right now we can see a lot of problems on the left that have to do with some of the effects of militancy, of these abstractions that become dominant spooks. You know, I think no one's looking too pretty right now.
Yeah, there can always be excess, I guess is the way to look at it. You know, another thing I wanted to cover was, you know, high weirdness and occultism are, you know, sort of meshed together. And I can also be very critical of occultism at times, although it depends on what it is. Like, you know, I'm pretty defensive of the people that are into, you know, the astrology girls. I know so many guys that get mad about that. I'm like, I mean, it's perfectly harmless. And, you know, I've often wondered if girls are vetting guys when they do that, because the guy that says, oh, that's all hogwash, and, you know, starts going off about it is probably not the kind of guy you want to date. But my issue with occultism is I feel like the idea of initiation, individual initiation, can be very hierarchical and elitist. And I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, sure. You're right. Absolutely. I mean, that initiation in its most general sense does imply a kind of, you know, an individual moving from one larger kind of reality to a more specific or rare or in some ways higher form. And some initiatic societies are extraordinarily hierarchical, but others are not, you know, and there is also an anarcho left current of initiation and occultism that's really powerful. There's Erica Lagrange, I think, but she just wrote a wonderful book about the sort of esoteric origins of anarchism within secret and occult societies. So they're within the kind of history of the occult, you can kind of, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about studying the occult, about studying the history of esotericism, let's say in the modern West. Like,
are you familiar with Simone Weil? She was a French philosopher and a leftist activist, but she was also a mystic. So this does exist on the left more than people realize.
Oh, absolutely. No, and especially when you get to the same, to connect it to our earlier conversation, when you get to this problem of, okay, if you really hate the state and you're not just a selfish individualist, you know, cowboy who just wants to live out on your ranch and be able to do whatever you want to do, if you're still imagining, well, what is going to, you know, compose social reality? What is it? And one answer is this kind of erotic, magical, enchanted, earthy vibrations of reality, you know, this kind of like delicious Tao, you know, like in the Taoist sense, that is going to carry that if you just give up your attempt to control, you give up your attempt to create hierarchy and create leaders, that if you get that stuff out of the way, that there's going to be a kind of like inherent juiciness to reality that will enable social forms to exist. And I'm not saying that that's true. It's probably not really true, although it's true in some ways, hopefully. But that if you have that kind of ideology, then occult ideas are really good ways to point to that, that there's some kind of inherent magic in existence or in the body or in nature that is going to carry the day, that that's all we have to rely on. We don't need all this other stuff because that's going to carry it forward. So that sort of more imminent as opposed to transcendent ideas of power or the sacred do lend themselves to forms of collective action and collective experience that are ecstatic, erotic, enthusiastic, and deeply collective. So that tension is within the very current. However, I think it's very important to recognize that overall the occult leans right. Overall, it leans hierarchical. It leans traditionalist. It leans, you know, that there's a higher man who's able to see through the delusions that absorb most of us in our day to day lives. So it's the same kind of thing. You can find those currents of initiation that aren't explicitly hierarchical or totalitarian or top down or whatever. Peter Lamborn Wilson is another good example of an anarchist thinker who's very interested in the problem of spiritual initiation because it's ultimately a problem of power. Who gets to say who's really initiated? If I have a dream where I encounter a sacred being who initiates me into some different modality of experience and gives me some teaching and transmission, and I start the next day and go, I'm initiated, and I start a group, no one's going to stop me. It might not succeed, but no one can stop me because in some sense the dream initiated me or a book initiated me. So initiation itself, once you take it out of the context of an organized hierarchy, is also already, and then it becomes more of a radical potential. So you can actually, there is a radicalism in the idea of initiation that is outside of the boundaries of these traditional organizations. But for the most part, the traditional idea of climbing up a hierarchy that has created the more visible forms of occultism and occult tradition.
Well, you know, before we begin to wrap up here, it's interesting. You mentioned how there's sort of excess on both sides of the political spectrum. And I tend to think there's more excess on the right, and that's probably my own biases or my own spooks, as Max Stirner would say. But there are things that make me scratch my head with the left sometimes. I'm seeing leftists now, for instance, that are sort of taking a conspiratorial view on even, and this is a minority, sort of an edgy left minority that takes the view that, you know, say Greta Thunberg, the Swedish climate change activist, that she's just being manipulated and has no autonomy, and she's being used by neoliberalism. And the right has that same view, except they replace neoliberalism with George Soros. And I notice this all across the political spectrum now, is, you know, there's infighting in the left and the right, and there probably always has been, but it seems so much more pronounced now on all sides. You know, it's everyone against everyone else. And to me, it's almost like we're experiencing a collective chapel perilous. What are your thoughts on that? Maybe that we're living in a collective chapel perilous experience politically.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, when I started writing High Weirdness, and I just wanted to, you know, write as a historian. I wanted to write about the 70s. I wanted to write about these three figures and their books and how they worked. And, you know, that's what I did for the most part. But as I was writing it, in some extent, with all of the figures, but certainly with Wilson, is the more I was looking closely at, you know, the role of tricksters, of media pranks, of ideas of the breakdown of fiction and reality, you know, the ominous implications, the ominous contemporary implications of his ideas and some of these practices, associated practices and states of consciousness, became more and more pressing. And while I didn't spend too much time dealing with that, I did talk about it some in the conclusion and a little bit in the Wilson chapter and a few places throughout. The book is very much written as a kind of mirror for where we are, even though it's mostly about the 70s. I think your insight there is pretty correct that one way of looking, I mean, I think of it as sort of the meltdown of consensus reality, but I think saying a collective, Chapel Perilous is a really is a really good place to be. It poses some really interesting problems of how to think. And, you know, you can kind of line up. There's a lot of people want you to line up, you know, get your position down and then resonate with that position. You know, whether you're taking the skeptical, left perspective, where anything that makes the mainstream media is being manipulated by neoliberalism, because neoliberalism is everywhere, or you take from a right wing perspective that it's, you know, it's all part of this globalist plot and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, everyone's sort of scripts now when it comes to how they talk about politics. Everyone's a brand.
Everyone's just, and you can think about it in terms of that, the language of resonance is an interesting one, where you're finding the perspective that you're part of, and then you just keep running that over and over again. I mean, a lot of Twitter works like that. A lot of the conversation about race works like that. It's, you know, it, and so in relationship to that, I go back and actually think that if Wilson was able to, in some ways, show some of the tricks that would help produce this situation, fake news, the idea of fake news, conspiracy as a seductive logic, playing with conspiracy as a game.
I interject real quickly?
Sure.
I just wanted to say, it's funny because I think a lot of people think of Robert Anton Wilson as just a conspiracy believer, right? He's the exact opposite. It's interesting. He was really, really against, the Satanic Panic, which I find interesting because a lot of these groups like SMART, the Stop Mind Control and Ritual Abuse Today, they're the Ritual Abuse Survivor Group. They've often said things like, well, even if my experience isn't factually true, the feeling of it is true. They almost take a Chapel Perilous view on it, and they use it in a way that I think is very negative and disturbing and can hurt people. But it's interesting how these ideas can get twisted in a lot of ways by different forces.
Yeah, it's twisted left and right, you know. But I also think that Wilson offers a little bit of a medicine. And, you know, at this point, I'm far from thinking that anything is a solution. I think the problems are so complicated. But that doesn't mean that we don't move towards that we don't develop strategies or tactics that enable us to interact with or move forward in our situation better than if we don't develop them. And I think one element is to take on the existential responsibility of being an individual. And I don't mean an individual separate from collectivities. I mean an individual who's enmeshed in all of these myriads of systems, technological, cultural, environmental, cosmic, you know, material, food, whatever, who's enmeshed in them, but recognizes that there is something about singularity. And what I mean by that is that you don't just propagate the resonance, don't just propagate the script, don't just find your location and then sit there and attack the enemies that have already been constructed for you by the script that you're taking in. And really intelligent people do this all the time, and it's clearly a mass. I don't know what to say. I mean, it's part of this collective Chapel Perilous you're talking about. And while I don't have any solutions on the other side of it, it's not like I think that if we do start doing this, we're going to come up with the answer. We're going to come up with the way to steer the ship of global catastrophe towards a better direction. I'm not making any claims like that. But I am saying that it's really clear to me the way that the spooks or the scripts are running the show, and that the kind of algorithmic pressure of those things is part of the distortion factor that is creating the Chapel Perilous situation. So that recovering the vulnerability, the fear, the existential risk, and the courage of being a singular thinker who does not simply reproduce scripts, who begins to try to understand how those scripts are working, how these different positions are being are interrelating in this larger system, who starts to move up, if you will, the kind of scale of perspective while still being invested in your fundamental values, the things you want to happen, your visions for a better world. Like, it's not about letting those things go. But I mean, I really think we're in a situation where, like, most people are getting kind of vampirized by their scripts, and particularly in social media, particularly in political discourse, particularly in, you know, any institutional, you know, discourse around the left and the right. And so some of that old school, not asshole libertarian, but good, you know, anarcho existentialist into the breach. Here we are in a collective psychedelic freakout. Let's keep our wits about us while recognizing that, you know, indeed the rug has been pulled out from under us, and we're at least in the moment in a different kind of world. So I do think these resonances are really important, and that ultimately ended up being the most valuable thing for me personally in writing my book, was to think about this very strange 70s subcultural weirdness, increasingly seeing how central it is to contemporary experience, and you know, some of the challenges that raises, but also I think some of the solutions. In this case, I think the weird have an edge on the normies, in terms of how, and I don't mean that in the way that the right calls people normies. I just mean that I think a lot of the right are normies too. But, you know, the fact that the right has absorbed so many of the elements of the counterculture, or Wilsonian elements as well, you know, that you know, it's we're in a new kind of ballgame, and it doesn't mean that that these tools or perspectives are inherently helpful or inherently chaotic or inherently destructive. It means that there's a sort of new logic afoot, and it doesn't follow the old positionality the way that we might want it to. So it's time, we all have to kind of jump into the breach.
Well, I was going to say, but before you go, it's, if I can relate something real quick, and this to me is, I think we're living in the culture of high weirdness now, and I'll give you an example, and then maybe we can close out on sort of how the cultural moment, the zeitgeist, seems to be high weirdness. But, you know, I used to go to some of the conspiracy cons in the 2000s, and I remember one of the books that people would always be selling were books like Transformation of America or Thanks for the Memories, which were supposedly by these alleged survivors of an MKUltra subproject called Project Monarch. I don't think it exists at all, and it was supposedly about mind-controlled sex slaves for the CIA. And people, when you would ask for the books, they sort of had them under a table, and asking for them, it was like you were asking for, like, pornography or, like, illicit material or something. I often considered those books to almost be like the pornography of conspiracy culture. But, you know, when Trump ran for office, I was reading a story about how he had a donor who believed his girlfriend or wife was a Project Monarch victim. And it was in a mainstream news story. You know, this QAnon stuff also borrows heavily from that. And I'm just like, I never thought in my wildest dreams that I would be reading about this conspiracy culture stuff that used to be underground, and now it's, you know, getting covered by mainstream media sources. Not necessarily as like, we believe this thing, but even that it's permeated into the culture that much, just, it kind of blows my mind.
Yeah, it's. I mean, we're, you know, the counterculture, conspiracy, the occult, it's all being mainstreamed. It's all part of our kind of framework of reference. And as it becomes part of it, and psychedelics, as it becomes part of it, it helps produce this chapel perilous situation, because it inevitably leads to questions of reality, questions of trust, as well as the invitation to include and weave altered states of consciousness into consensus reality. You know, in the old days, like, your altered states were over there. You know, you're either a freak, or you're, you know, having your psychedelic trip at the dead show or whatever. You're doing your little occult ritual in some kind of strange group that might be conservative, it might be liberal, but it's sort of off the side. But now it's like, hey, bring it all in. We're all sort of surfing these various stages of consciousness and media and entertainment culture are more and more psychedelic or more and more sort of, you know, visceral or virtual. And, you know, it's just like all the boundaries are sort of are breaking down. So, but it also means it's more banal, you know, which is kind of like for someone like me, it's really noticeable. Like the, like you say, when it was something you'd have to ask for, it was like under the table. It was like weird. It was like something kind of spooky or charged. And now it's just there. It just means that it's just a demographic. There's the QAnon demographic or the Project Monarch demographic, and they're just out there. And you know, they have they're all lined together. They have the Facebook group, just the way that the bowling people do or the fantasy football people do. And in a way, they're just part of the sort of banal extent of, you know, digital multiplicity. Late stage capitalism.
Well, it's interesting to me because I just thought of another example of, you know, I used to be real into like the sort of industrial prankster culture of RE Search and stuff like that. And a lot of those guys, like Boy Rice, were into like sort of kitschy counterculture stuff and making it like a lot darker. And a lot of them were into like Tiny Tim or, you know, like the Banana Splits. And I thought it was funny recently because, you know, they were all into making that stuff seem a little bit darker and like playing with fan fictions of it and whatnot. And, you know, lo and behold, Sci-Fi is making just made a Banana Split slasher movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's part of it, too, is that there's something repulsive in horribly pop things that is now more and more just kind of part of the flow. You know, it's like there's something like that tinniness or whatever is and so but it's a strange dialectic because as that stuff gets more mainstream, it loses its charge. And so if it's there just for its charge, then that charge has a shelf life and it's going, you know, but it's not just that. It's not just about the charge of the outre. There's something else going on. It's like Burning Man. You know, Burning Man was totally super underground, super radical, super anarcho-libertarian. And now it really is just mainstream. It's just another part of the mainstream. It's a little freakier than your average, you know. But straight people, like real normies, they're hard to find. You know, everybody's got a tattoo or they're doing meditation or they're, you know, they're like, you know, dreaming of the Reich or something. I mean, it's like left and right. It's that norm is increasingly, you know, hard to find, so much so that maybe it becomes the kind of the next fantastic investment is into some idea of the norm. So in a way, it's like, you know, we're all in these waters now.
Well, you know, final note here, because I always like to end on a positive note. You said you can't see necessarily any clear solutions, but there was one idea I liked from Robert Anton Wolfson. He used to talk about loser and winner scripts, and he's like, you should take your loser script and turn it into a winner script. Instead of thinking the world is conspiring against you, you should start your own secret society and, you know, start your own conspiracy. Maybe the world is conspiring to shower you with all its grace and wonder, you know. I kind of like Robert Anton Wilson's take on that.
No, regardless of how dark one's political view is or how urgent, how serious, how gloomy the world seems, I think what you just said is also true. It's just true that however much you are invested in your particular view of the political or environmental reality and however true that view is, there, it is also the case that we are just script running animals. That's what we do. We run scripts. And to be aware of that process and to be aware of the negativity that's in most of our scripts and to just be willing to shift it, it doesn't mean you become, you know, a bubble-headed new ager who creates your own reality. And so you don't see, you know, oh, I don't believe, you know, I'm not sure. It's all just maybe a story we're telling about the end of the world. It's like, no, climate change is real. No, species extinction is real. But I'm still telling a negative story about, you know, whatever. I didn't make my dad happy and I got to like prove to him something, or I'm a miserable jerk, or I don't deserve happiness. Or, you know, we have these other scripts that we're running all the time. And sometimes the miserableness of the world justifies our miserablest narratives. And I don't believe in that at all. I think it's we're still alive, man. There's still juice. It's there's still, you know, puppies and, you know, the glint in your lover's eye, and there's a lot of good stuff out there. But if you and you got to be able to like live in a multiplicity where you are taking control or encouraging rewriting your scripts in a more engaged way that just makes for a more interesting world, a more interesting life, while being fully aware as best you can about what, about understanding what's actually going on and not just, you know, hiding in some little hedonic bubble. I think we're called upon to do both, and it's contradictory and tough. That's what it is to be in Chapel Perilous. We got to think on multiple levels that don't always resonate at the same time.
Well, you know what, Eric? I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Can you let my listeners know how they can get a hold of High Weirdness? And if there's any other projects you're working on, I don't know if you still do the Expanding Mind podcast or if you have any other books in the works.
Yeah, I'm. You know, High Weirdness is out there. The paperback edition is going to come out. I think it'll be available next month, as well as the e-book. And we're working on an audiobook that probably will take a number more months. So that's still cooking. The main place to track me is on my long running website, technosis.com, technosis.com. And
that's also a cult classic media studies book, folks. You should read Eric Davis's Technosis.
Thank you for much. Yeah, that one sort of like our discussion today ended up proving more prophetic than I had ever expected. And it's kind of it's sort of a mixed blessing because some of the prophecies aren't that sweet. But anyway, so that's my stuff. Expanding Mind will come back in some form. I'm on a hiatus now. I'm jiggering with the concept. I did that weekly show for almost a decade, and I want to shift things around. But if you go to my website, you can sign up for my very occasional mailing list, and that's the main thing I use to communicate with people. So I encourage you to check it out, and there's tons of writing and old podcasts on the show. So,
well, like I said, thank you again for coming on Parallax Views, Eric Davis. And folks, check out High Weirdness.
Well, thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Eric Davis, author of High Weirdness, Drugs, Esoterica, and Visionary Experience in the 70s. Have your own thoughts on this episode that you'd like to share with me and my listeners? Drop me a line at the Parallax Views Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. If you are a Parallax Views Patreon supporter, I just released a new episode of Parallax Views, The Week That Was, where my pal Casey and I examine those news stories that fall down the memory hole after their 15 minutes, or is that 15 seconds, of fame. So, if you're interested in supporting Parallax Views, check that out on Patreon. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views. With Parallax Views. To Parallax Views. With Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I'm
I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.